From the heartland of America, the gateway to the West, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie, and welcome to Coast AM. Next hour, time for stories of high strangeness with investigative reporter Linda Moulton Howe. She's back. She was off last month on some family business, but she's got some great stories for you tonight. Here's what's happening. NOAA forecasters estimating a 40% chance of an M-class flare or a 5% chance of an X flare. Oh boy, just what we need. The likely source is sunspot AR2146, which has a beta gamma delta magnetic field that harbors energy for strong eruptions. Come on, folks, fix the grid. I've been saying it for some time now. A new English language Al-Qaeda magazine features a how-to article on making car bombs and suggests terror targets in the United States, including casinos in Las Vegas, oil tankers, and military colleges, and implies that an attack is imminent. Let's check in with our expert, Jerome Corsi, who writes for WND.com and noted author, his most recent book, Hunting Hitler. Jerry, we've heard this before from them, but I don't know, this sounds like a little more urgent.
Well, George, I think it is more urgent, and with the number of U.S. recruits that ISIS has, we can't discount the possibility there may be U.S. operatives that could attack Las Vegas. I think the truth is we're behind the curve on intelligence with ISIS, and it's frightening to think that ISIS might have operatives available in the United States to conduct other terrorist attacks like we saw in the Boston Marathon.
Jerry, if for some reason they do attack here on our mainland, do you think it's time to pull out all the weapons, I mean the heavy machinery that we haven't used since 1945?
Well, George, it's a possibility. I mean, and I know what you're referring to, but, you know, I think President Obama is not anxious to engage in another war. This is another very difficult case that's going to be tied to, you know, are we going to really back Assad or be aligned with Assad and going after ISIS? It's a very complicated issue, and we've got to do something to protect the homeland and Las Vegas and other sites in the United States, but I'm not sure that taking military action in the Middle East is going to necessarily be effective. It's a very, very difficult question right now.
And then, of course, we have those who believe that this is all contrived to keep the war machine going. So what do you say about that?
Well, George, I think it's got to be taken into consideration. I mean, we've been in the Middle East now for how many years, and we still have these radical terrorist groups operative, and it's going to be a question as to what we're going to need to do to get rid of the terrorist groups that are dangerous to homeland security attacks. We don't need more Boston Marathons, and we don't need more 9/11s, and I'm sure the American people will react to make sure we protect the United States, but at the same time, I think it's a very difficult question of how much additional war we want in the Middle East.
Okay, Jerry, thank you so much. You can track Jerry's work, WND.com. Declaring that Russian troops had crossed into the Ukraine, the president there canceled a planned visit to Turkey and convened a meeting of the National Security Council to focus on the marked aggravation of the situation in the southeast part of his country. See what happens there. The FBI is investigating hacking attacks on 7 of the top 15 banks, including one against J.P. Morgan Chase, according to someone with direct knowledge of the attack. Now, the extent of the damage and who did it is still unknown. A person who analyzed the attack said the hackers used sophisticated, never-before-seen malware to get deep enough into the bank's computer systems to delete and manipulate records. Well, it's another small sliver of information in the expanse of the mystery surrounding Malaysia Airlines Flight 370, which went down March 8th, or it landed on March 8th. The failed satellite phone call suggests the missing passenger jet may have turned south slightly earlier than previously thought during its journey after Flight 370 dropped off radar on March 8th. Malaysia Airlines ground staff tried to make contact with the plane using a satellite phone. The attempt was unsuccessful, but subsequent analysis of the failed call has given experts a better idea of the aircraft's position and where it was traveling. Let's check in with the expert and author of the downing of TWA Flight 800, Jim Sanders. Jim, this thing continues. It goes on and on and on.
It does, and there's absolutely nothing in the statements that are being put out that are factual. That is the final line on this. What they have is they knew the plane was, when it was last seen on military radar, it was going in a specific direction, west, northwest. So projecting out from there, if there were no course deviations in the about 20 minutes after it went off the military radar, then they would have expected it to be at a certain point. Now, they, using their untested, uncalibrated equipment, which they have no idea whether they're looking at something that gets you within 5 feet or 5 miles or 100 miles of where the plane could be, it could have been to the north or the south. They are unable to tell you whether it was to the north or to the south. They can't tell you it was a turn. It was a course correction, perhaps, a course deviation, a course change. It just put the plane slightly somewhere to the north or to the south, other than where they thought it was. And again, I must emphasize, this is completely untested and uncalibrated equipment. Everything they're saying in terms of making a turning movement to the south and then fine-tuning where it might be is such total propaganda that you have to strongly suspect that they have, in fact, finished their salting operation down to the south, and Eureka, we found it here sometime in the next, who knows, you know, how, whether it's weeks or months down the road.
We're going to watch this. Jim, thanks again, and thanks for being with us since this all started on March 8th. Even before that, he's been a guest on Coast to Coast as we talked about his theories about what took down TWA Flight 800. The Ebola outbreak in West Africa has killed more than 1,552 people out of 3,069 known cases in four countries and continues to accelerate, according to the World Health Organization. The epidemic in the region, the deadliest since that disease was first discovered back in 1976, has killed nearly as many people as all the previous known outbreaks combined. Currently, there is no centralized registry or database for persons who have gone missing in our national parks and forests or on the Bureau of Land Management lands. If search and rescue parties are unable to locate the missing, no records are required to be kept by our government about the missing person, case, or the circumstances surrounding the event. Now, as you know, we have talked quite a bit about people missing, disappearing from parks and forests. And up next, David Politis joins us again, author of Missing 411, two different versions. He will tell us about a campaign to hopefully get a database going. David's next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, David Politis with us this hour. David received his undergraduate, graduate degrees from the University of San Francisco. He is the author of Missing 411, two different versions, The Devils in the Detail in North America and Beyond. He has been on our show quite regularly as we talk about the bizarre story of missing people from our national parks and forests or Bureau of Land Management lands. They simply just disappear. And he's got a campaign which we'll talk to you about as well. David, welcome back, first of all.
Hey, thanks for having me, George.
Oh, my pleasure. Very important. For brand new listeners, David, give us a quick overview, if you can, on your work, Missing 411.
Well, it started about 5 years ago on a recommendation from two National Park Service rangers. They approached me. They said that they had worked in the parks for a number of years and had seen a lot of missing people. They reported that there was a lot of publicity on the first 7 to 10 days. After that, there was nothing. There was no follow-up. They couldn't even find records of people that they knew that they were looking for. And they thought that there needed to be some concerted effort to really get to the bottom of it. And that's how it all started. And since then, we filed dozens and dozens of Freedom of Information Act requests against the Park Service. And they've repeatedly said that they don't keep lists of missing people. They don't have records about the numbers of missing people in the parks. When I'm a published author, so I claimed an author's exemption under the Freedom of Information Act. And they stated that my books weren't in enough libraries to qualify. And as such, they wanted to charge us $34,000 for them to put together a list of people from Yosemite and $1.4 million from their entire system.
That's crazy. Absolutely crazy. Now, obviously, some of the missing people show up dead. Their bodies are located. But that's few and far between. Most of these people, David, simply vanish in thin air, don't they?
That's correct. But some of the bodies that are found offer some of the most interesting of clues and add more mystery to the entire topic. One of the things that we did tonight is we released a video we did on a disappearance this year. It's on our site right now. You can look at it under the YouTube section. It involves a Dr. James McGrogan from Indiana. And Dr. McGrogan came out to Vail, Colorado, with a few other physician friends in March of this year. And they were going to climb a mountain with the use of skis, mountain mm-hmm. climbing boots, etc. And on the way up that mountain, as happens a number of times, he paused with his friends and he says, "Hey, I'm going to go up ahead and you guys rest." And he started to go up the trail. It's just a normal hiking trail at this point. And when the people got to the next point, he wasn't there. Well, they went to the following point, he wasn't there. And at that point, they went back down the mountain. They reported to Vail Safety Services that he was missing. And that started a five-day search for him. Now, McGrogan was a marathon runner. And there's two things that we've keyed on in the last 3 years. There's an abnormal amount of missing intellectuals. I'm talking about very highly educated, and physicians fall into that.
Okay.
Second one is, for some reason, there's an abnormal amount of marathon runners or triathletes that have disappeared in that same last 3 years in the mountain.
Huh.
And McGrogan was one of these guys that just never gave up. He had that kind of attitude, everybody said. Well, he was going up what's called Spraddle Creek Trailhead, and he was trying to get to a place called Iceman's Hut, and it's really a house that's up there at about 10,000 feet. When the guys got there, he wasn't there. Again, a big search for 5 days, and they find nothing. And there were probably over 80 different helicopter overflights of this area over about an 18-square-mile region. Search and Rescue went in there on foot, and they didn't find any unusual tracks leaving that main trail. And at 8 to 10,000 feet, there's a lot of snow up there. And they didn't find anything. And so at that five-day period, they called the search off. Now, McGrogan was one of these guys that came equipped for anything.
He was always ready for anything.
Always ready. He had a cell phone with a backup battery. He had GPS with a backup battery. He had what's called a split ski board, and it's a snowboard that breaks in half, and you can put them on like cross-country skis with sleeves. He had a shovel. He had a probe. He had an avalanche beacon. He had food, water, and medical supplies. And we found this out from interviewing the people that rented him the equipment, and this is all on that video that's online.
So this doctor was not reckless at all.
No, and to beat that, George, he was an ER physician, so he was somebody that was used to making quick decisions, logical decisions, informed decisions. So the reason they called the search at that fifth day, by the way, was a heavy storm moved in. That's something that's current with what we study.
Mm-hmm.
The following 20 days, nothing's found. They continue some overflights, they do some other things, but they find nothing. Now, the third valley, as you go east from where he disappeared, 4.5 air miles away, there's an area where some people were going up this valley, still heavy snow, and it's called Booth Creek Falls. It's about 1.6 to 1.8 miles from a major highway, Highway 70. And there they found his body in an ice chute in the creek. Now, you said something really important here. And you said, well, you know, sometimes bodies are found. And I said, well, when those bodies are found, if you dig real hard in a lot of these cases, you're going to find something unusual. And it's not going to be publicly given right away by the coroner mm-hmm. or the sheriff.
But they know.
But they know something. And in Colorado, we have a mandatory disclosure law about all governmental reports. Well, when they found Dr. McGrogan's body, he was wearing a helmet. He was wearing black leggings, black socks, a dark blue shirt. What he wasn't wearing was gloves, no coat, and no boots.
Very, very unusual.
He had his GPS in his backpack, and it was a GPS watch. And if he was missing, why wouldn't he have had that wristwatch on?
That's right.
The coroner's report, we got it, and it said that he had an injury to the left side of his chest, he had a head injury, and he had a broken femur. All that would have been fairly consistent with a big fall. The problem is that the way McGrogan would have had to have gotten from A to B would have been a trip of 12 to 16 miles up and down several mountains and through valleys. And when we talked to the people that rented him this stuff, they're experts, and they said, Dave, nobody makes that trip. It's an insanely difficult
trip. Well, and he wouldn't have left his group that far, would he?
You're right, George. And the thing that becomes very tantamount from the very beginning when you go up there and you look at the video is that in many of these high places, you can see the city of Vail down the valley. And everybody knows safety is down. It's not up, and it's not over mountains. And the other interesting point is the coroner stated in his report that Dr. McGrogan's cell phone worked. And when we were filming where his body was found, our cell phones worked. Yet his cell phone was found turned off in his backpack. So why would the GPS be in the backpack? Why would his skis be tied to his backpack? And why wouldn't he have been wearing them? This doesn't make any sense.
And were the boots found by the body, or did they ever find them at all?
They were never found.
That's weird.
Now, that's just one case where at the onset, and when you read public reports about this, it's not going to seem strange at all. No one says anything about the boots. When we talked to the ski shop that rented them, they go, nobody told us that. And they kind of challenged us until I showed them the coroner's report, and they said, oh, that is really weird.
I mean, that's the strangest part of the entire story, besides the fact that he was so far away from his group, which he probably would never do. It just seems like he kept going on and on and on, or something took him on and on and on.
Many people have said that. And you talk about the no boots or no shoes, and there's a large percentage of the reports that I've written about where that occurs. And one of them right away stuck out to us when we looked at this, and that is in February of 75, a 19-year-old named Charles McCullough went to Crater Lake National Park. And there were 20 to 30-foot snowdrifts around the lake at that time. And he went up sightseeing, and he disappeared. And his dad came out from Virginia and said, hey, my son wouldn't do something stupid. You know, he's really a smart kid. He took a semester off just to tour the national parks. Come on, you got to help us find him. He asked the FBI to get involved. They refused. Make a long story short, months later, 10, 12 months later, during the fall and early summer months, some people were backpacking in an area 12 miles back into the backcountry from the lake. And they saw a skullcap laying on the ground, and they got out and they called the Rangers. And I found a man named Marion Jack, who was a law enforcement ranger, and I interviewed him at his house. I had to interview him at his house because the National Park Service said that they didn't have any copies of this report, and you're not going to find anything about this case anywhere. And if I hadn't contacted Marion, the facts of this would never come out.
Stranger and stranger.
He and his partner ride on horseback 12 miles in, and they get into a box canyon with a very small creek. They step over a top of a big Douglas fir tree, and he said, Dave, it looks like this man unbuckled his pants, dropped his fly, and pulled his pants down to his toes and disappeared. There were bones in the socks. The buckle was undone. The zipper was down. There were no boots. There was no coat. There was no shirt. Yet this man disappeared in the middle of winter with 20 to 30-foot snowdrifts. Marion said he was so disturbed, he and his partner, by what they saw, they backed out. They called for an FBI evidence response team from Portland to come down and work the scene because it was so unbelievable. And I asked him, how did this man get to that location in the middle of winter? He goes, Dave, physically impossible.
Something's taking them there, David. It's got to be. You know, when we originally talked some time ago, you know, I asked you if you thought there was some serial killers running around the park and things like that. And though that may be possible, you kind of hinted that that's not what you're talking about. Am I right?
George, it would be utterly impossible. I mean, we're working at essentially 1,200 cases now across North America, and there, to think that on these remote areas there's a serial killer walking around abducting people, people would fight. They would fight for their lives, and that's not happening.
And you wouldn't have these bizarre things happening to their bodies. David, we're going to talk more about this and also get into your Missing People campaign on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. David Palandis with us as we talk about missing people and his campaign that we'll talk about as well. David, I can only imagine these people who are in the park systems and whatever is happening to them, the horror, the just absolute horror that they must face when this thing encounters them or whatever it is.
You know, George, I get a lot of emails every week about things that we're talking about, and the common theme is scared to death. Because many, many times, these cases that I've documented, physicians can't determine the cause of death, which is hard to believe, but the statement scared to death comes up a lot.
I think so, too. And you know, I know you don't like to publicly jump in and say, this is what I think is going on, but can you give us maybe three possible scenarios in your mind?
I'll give you the most common ones. And number one is always the aliens, extraterrestrials. The other one is there's a lot of people out there that believe our government is doing something and sampling us or I don't understand it. I hear variations from it all the time. Mm-hmm. That's another one. The other one that we hear a lot is something called reptoids, and I really don't know anything about it other than what I've read online.
The reptoids are apparently possible extraterrestrials or subterranean creatures that have been on this planet for a long, long time, and that they, you know, pop up and maybe they grab these folks or something like that. You know, I would add a couple possibilities, too, and that would be one, Bigfoot, though we don't normally get violent Bigfoot cases, so and these are all ending in violence. The other would be some kind of portal or dimension that these people cross in, and then something horrible happens to them by some entity, and then they're dumped back into our dimension again. I don't know. It's weird.
It's definitely weird, yes. And I'll address the Bigfoot issue just momentarily, and that is it's hard to fathom how any terrestrial creature could take someone and leave no tracks and not be visible. Specifically in the McGrogan case, he's on a trail. There's no marks through the snow, no helicopters see any tracks going over the top of a 12,000-foot mountain. So how did he get there?
Yeah. So then we're dealing with something from above, like a craft that kind of picks them up, or again, my dimensional theory.
You know, somebody gave a great visual to me the other day, someone very close to me, and they said, Dave, it's, you go to the arcade, and you're playing that game where there's an arm that comes down and grabs the toy.
Which I never can do, by the way.
The
arm is always smaller than the toy or something.
Right. And then moves it across the machine and then drops it somewhere else. And this person said, you know, that's what this reminds me of.
That's an interesting analogy. Maybe an invisible arm.
Well, along the lines of that, I mean, thousands of people have been reading about this, and they have some theories, and they've heard me on your show, and they've heard me talk about that we need to do something as a society to get accountability about this issue. And the obstacles that we faced in just trying to find the 1,200 cases we found has taken us 5 years. And if you went to the city of Los Angeles and you talked to their police chief about the number of missing people in your city, he would tell you within minutes how many there are, how many there have been in the last week.
Yep.
Most large cities have a database that's online where you could look at the missing people.
Who they are, where they were last seen, he'll have it all.
Exactly. And it's the politically correct thing to do. Now, unbelievably, our government has the National Park Service, the Bureau of Land Management, and the National Park Service. They have a large contingent of federally trained law enforcement officers working inside their system. These people have gotten some of the best law enforcement training in the nation. Yet they won't put up a database, and they won't account for missing people, and they say they don't even track missing people. So one of the readers kind of took the horns and decided to put online a...
And we've got a link for you at coasttocoastam.com.
Absolutely.
It's a petition, isn't it?
Correct. And what we're asking is for a centralized registry and database of people who have gone missing in national parks and on Bureau of Land Management property, that it can be searchable, the records can be public. And I think a lot of the public may not understand that missing people are not criminal issues. It's something weird that law enforcement investigates that's not criminal. And so it doesn't hold that same level in jurisdiction and in investigation as a crime does. So the reports on the people being missing, that's why you see them online in different jurisdictions. So what we're asking for is so minimal compared to what the national city does that it's hard to believe that they're not doing it now.
They should have been doing it a long time ago. You're right.
So what we're asking people to do, there's no money involved. Just go to the link, sign it, read what it says. And then there's a series of comments there by people who have read the books and can understand the linkage between the petition and what we've been doing and why this really needs to be done. The public doesn't understand where these pitfalls in our national parks are located. Namely, the biggest one is Yosemite. It's the largest cluster of missing people anywhere in North America.
If you had to add up the amount of missing people, how many do you think there would be?
You know, I honestly don't think that we're doing a great job at it just because there's so much hidden that's hard to find. An example is somebody may go missing. They may find the body, but the chances of us getting a coroner's report, as we did in Dr. McGrogan's case, is minimal.
Minimal, yeah.
Because people aren't going to give up those documents in most cases. So in reality, a lot of the missing cases, especially the cases where someone's fallen to their death, and if you start paying attention, there's a lot of people that are alone hiking in the woods that fall to their deaths. And I've talked to a lot of professional climbers, and I said, am I the only one who, when I'm out there alone, I'm extra careful? Because if I fall, there's no one there to help me.
And if you fall, David, at least you're going to keep your boots on.
Oh, I can guarantee that, George.
Jeez, that's what's so weird. Let's take a few calls here for you. Let's go to Scott in Washington, D.C., east of the Rockies. Scotty, go ahead.
Oh, okay. I had an experience of being lost in the National Forest here in Virginia, up in Highland County, which is the least populated county in Virginia and probably east of the Appalachian Mountains. And I was at a friend's farm, and I wanted to see a sunset. So I went up to the top of the hill to watch the sun go down in the valley beyond, which was where the National Forest was. I turned around to go back to the house, and I thought I was walking back, and I thought I was walking back, and after a while, I realized I was lost, and I kept trying to find my way back. I didn't feel like I was moving around that much, but very shortly, I realized I'm lost. Now, this was in October. I was wearing a T-shirt, blue jeans, and, running shoes, and the temperature dropped pretty low. And so I had to just stay in one place, kind of walk in circles to keep my body temperature up.
Were you scared,
Scott?
Wait for
the sun to come up.
Did you think this was it for you?
I didn't think it was, and I'll tell you why, because I knew that there was a highway that ran north and south to this ridge that I was on, and if I head due east, I'd hit the highway. And it wasn't a real highway, it's a two-lane road, really. And so I waited for the sun to come up, and I headed east, and I came on this cabin. you know, that sounds like a story in itself, but it wasn't. It was just a retired couple there who took me in, gave me breakfast, and they said, gee, you know, a lot of people get lost back there. And when I got back to my friend's house, I was 16 miles down that road from where they were.
Wow.
I couldn't believe it. And I they said that they had come up that hill looking for me, shouting for me. They even fired a gun in the air. I could not hear it. And I, you know, talked to some people. You know, the sheriff was going to come out the next day, and I talked to him, and he said, well, you know, almost everybody in this county has a story about being lost in those woods back there. And he said, you know, when you go back in there, you know, you get disoriented because there's a canopy of leaves over the top of you. You can't see the stars. You can't see a lot of things. If it's overcast, you're really kind of messed up. And at night, you're certainly messed up. And he said, you did the right thing. You just didn't panic, and you stayed in one place, and you remembered where things were, and you tried to find your way back. And he said, don't go back in there without, you know, matches, a compass, some kindling, you know, and a jacket, because the temperatures go down really quickly in the mountains. And and he said, you know, the trees themselves are like, you know, sound breaks. It's like you've got a wall of wood, you know, like hundreds of feet deep, blocking the, you know, the sound. You know, you can't hear things. And when I was out there, you know, I did hear things moving around. There were a lot of animals that come out at night. Some of them were pretty big, but they, you know, stayed away from me. And it was, you know, I guess, you know, if I had died out there, I think, you know, when you go into the woods, I think, you know, one of the things you said about people who were well-educated getting lost back there, I think, you know, one of the problems is that, you know, when we have a lot of education, we think we know everything, and that, you know, this is a totally different world. And, you know, we think, oh, it's nature, you know, it's kind of crunchy granola, and it's really nice. And, you know, we go back in there, and you realize that it's, you know, you're either going to eat something or something's going to eat you. And, you know, and I think if I had died, I would have been chow, you know, I would have been gone. And you know, we have deer in the woods around my house here, which is very close to the city. And, you know, you rarely find deer bones in there. And I think it's because, you know, the vultures get them and they're scavengers and, you know, they just get eaten.
Well, Scott, I am glad you got out of that alive. But, you know, there are a lot of people who do not. So, David, tell us the results once the petitions get signed. What happens?
Well, I think what we're going to do is we're going to try to take it to a congressman or a senator and get them to sponsor some legislation or ask for a hearing about it.
Well, that'll be smart. You need that. I'm trying to get the grid insulated against a EMP attack or an X flare, and that's like pulling teeth with Congress, but we're going to try with that too. So maybe we can both push. Let's go next to Richard in Bend, Oregon, first-time caller. Richard, thanks for calling. Go ahead.
Hi, thanks for taking my call, George.
Sure thing.
Been wanting to call you for a long time. I got a lot of things I want to talk about, but I'm going to just keep this short and brief. Me and my friend, we're hikers going ultralight backpacking in the Cascade Mountains and up to a mountain called Broken Top. It's west of the South Sister, and you got three sisters, Faith, Hope, and Charity. Well, anyhow, we hiked up the steep road up to a place called Big Mountain, a Big Meadow above Todd Lake. And we said, well, we'll camp here. It was a short hike up a hill from where we parked. And as we're getting, we decided to, for a campsite, this thing appeared right over our head. It might be what you're looking for, Mr. Plies. I don't know. But anyhow, it's this thing appeared over our heads. It was black and shiny, and it had these, like, sharp, triangular spear things shooting from it, and then it disappeared. And it was about 10 feet wide. And I said to my friend, did you see that? And he said, see what? And I got kind of nervous. Hello?
Yeah, we're listening to you.
Right? Okay, then I'm going to fish this. And then so I got out my tarp and, you know, and make a little shelter for myself, like ultralight backpackers use a tarp and a bivy and for the night and with a bug screen. And anyhow, as I was doing that, it appeared again. And, like, it was just this weird, non-asymmetrical-shaped object, whatever it was. It was black and shiny, and there's these things shooting out of it. And I just felt, got the creeps. I felt like the thing was going to, like, take us away or something.
Now, that is an interesting possibility. David, what if, you know, you mentioned the possibility that some people think government is doing this. What if some drones are flying around out there? Of course, other people should see them, but is that a possibility?
Well, one of the main issues, and I think we need to remind listeners, is that we work off a stringent profile. Not every missing case we look at, it has to fit this profile that we've established over the years. And one of the issues I've talked about on your show before that's highly, highly unusual is whatever is happening here is 100% effective. There's no hiccups. There's no almost. Because if there was, we would hear about it. And so I'm with you, George. It could be, I keep an open mind, it could be anything. But whatever it is, doesn't make a mistake.
No, it has not made a mistake. And how long do you think this has been going on?
We've got cases that fit the profile going back to 1760.
Holy Toledo. Well, that rules out government, doesn't it?
Yeah, I think it might.
Next up, we go to Mark in Westlake, Oregon. Welcome to the show. Mark, very quickly, go ahead.
Yes, good evening, George and David. David, when you were on George Knapp's show, I believe it was, several months ago, you had mentioned a case where the man was not taken. He was walking down a trail, and I believe it was in broad daylight. He came upon a distortion in front of him, not far in front of him, where everything on the other side of it, down trail, was actually not clear. But he put his foot into it, and he said his foot disappeared, if I remember correctly what you said. Now, you had mentioned the three or four scenarios, David, that this could be happening in, and then George added on the dimensional scenario where someone actually goes into a vortex. And it's funny because I had asked you about this the first time I think I heard you interview on George's show, because people would disappear around a curve in the trail, and they couldn't have gone anywhere. It's just, and that's happened, you know, many times where they virtually just disappear into thin air. And it would seem, possibly, that this the gentleman who had called just a few minutes ago, the device he saw in this scenario of a dimensional vortex, that they can actually project these vortexes any place, any time on the trail or anywhere else. And I think that could very well be what's happening. And I just find all of this very interesting. I certainly do appreciate you, gentlemen, doing your great work.
Thank you, David, and thank you for the phone call. I really appreciate that. David, as we begin to wrap things up, we've only got a little bit more than a minute here for you. I want you to, again, get out your website and ask people to sign this petition.
Absolutely. In fact, I had a few comments that people have gone on to Amazon tonight and tried to order the book and found prices on all four of the missing books at over $2,000. We don't sell on Amazon. People buy them from us and sell them there. If you come onto our site, they're only $24.95. So
that's quite a difference.
Quite a difference, yes. I'm not trying to steal from the people. And so it's the Can-Am Missing Project, canammissing.com. The link is on your site. And realistically, it doesn't cost you anything to sign this petition. And without Coast to Coast viewers, listeners helping us out, we'll never get there. So please just take a minute to read it and sign it.
Super. David, thank you so much. David Politis, again, we've got the link for the petition to sign at coasttocoastam.com. In a moment, investigative reporter Linda Moulton Howe joins us with some stories of high strangeness. Don't touch your dial. We'll be right back.